have promised and I have promised again, and now at long last I bring you the first part of The Untold Story of Carthage. Now, we're at a disadvantage when we study Carthage because almost all of our information on Carthage comes from their archenemies, the Romans. Contrary to popular belief, the Roman army did not sow the ground with salt after the 146 BC victory over Carthage. They did, however, thoroughly sack the place and burn just about anything they couldn't eat, sell, drink, or rape. We know the Carthaginians were Phoenicians. We know they used the alphabet that inspired the Greek, Latin, and Cyrillic alphabets. We know the Greeks get their word from book Biblio, from Byblos. That's the Phoenician city that grew rich on the papyrus trade, so we know the Phoenicians did a lot of writing, but no Phoenician literature has survived to the present day, so we're going to be doing a lot of speculating, we're going to be doing a lot of guessing, a lot of leaps of faith, and, you know, probably pulling a few things out of my posterior here and there, but with all those limitations in mind, let's take a look at Carthage starting at the beginning. Now, according to the Roman retelling of the Carthaginian origin stories, Carthage was founded somewhere between 825 and 814 BC by a princess of Tyre, a Phoenician princess named Elissa. She's also known as Dido. Dido leaves Tyre with an entourage after court intrigues involving her brother, King Pygmalion, and her family. There's a famous story in Virgil about a love affair between Dido and the Trojan hero Aeneas, who actually, this would be about 300-400 years or more before the founding of Carthage, so this is an anachronism. But it's become a famous story. Dido's suicide and self-immolation have been reproduced. One of the most famous operas, of course, would be Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. If you want to find it, there are two great versions of it. One is with Dame Janet Baker, the great British mezzo-soprano. The other one is with the great African-American singer Dame Jessie Norman. But either of them, the aria When I Am Laid in Earth, it's absolutely breathtaking. You'll love it. Trust me. Now, we don't know much about the woman behind Elissa or Dido. We do know that there was a Tyrian king named Pumetan in Greek. That would be Pygmalion. We know that Pumetan reigns in Tyre from about 831 to 785 BC. He comes to the throne at about the age of 9 or 10. Pumetan starts establishing Phoenician colonies all around the Western Mediterranean. And this is really a big change for the Phoenicians. For much of their history, certainly up to this time, the Phoenicians tended to treat the sea the way their nomadic ancestors would treat the desert. They'd have way stations along their trade routes, the same way that their nomadic ancestors would look for oases. They'd rest there while traveling their goods. Sometimes you'd see a few Phoenicians settle down amongst the locals. Under Pumetan, you start seeing the Phoenicians setting up something which is much more like what the Greeks would call the coloniae, the colonies. Pumetan builds a colony on Cyprus that's rich in copper. It's strategically located between the Aegean and the Levant. So there's a couple of trade routes there. They built cities and a couple of other strategic islands, namely Sicily and Sardinia. But Pumetan's greatest achievement would be forming a city on the coast of modern-day Tunisia. They called it Carthadash, New City. It would become, of course, Carthage to everybody else. The colonies were settled by wealthy Phoenicians who financed this. They bring their entourages with them. They bring their soldiers with them. This is very near the rich gold and silver mines of Hispania. That's mainly why they built this colony here at Carthage. So it's entirely possible that a woman from Tyrian royalty came here and was the first queen of Carthage. Now, another place where we have archaeological evidence of the Carthaginians is in the cities they founded in Hispania. For 400 years, Ibiza was a Punic colony. The Tyrians had set up a settlement at Gadir before the Carthaginians took over maintaining and populating it. That settlement's still thriving today as the Spanish city of Cadiz. And when you're in Spain, if you're at Cartagena, that got its start with Carthaginians colonizing a new Carthage. In Hispania, I'd mentioned before, they had gold and silver mines. They also have copper. They've got iron. Another very, very valuable thing that was located off the Spanish shores were murex snails. And murex snails were very interesting because one of the first things the Phoenicians got rich on, it's the dye the Romans used to dye the imperial robe. It's Tyrian purple. That's made from the secretions from murex snails. Murex snails were abundant off the Spanish shores, and that meant they could engage in making the Tyrian purple dye here in Hispania. When they had control over the Iberian coast, the Carthaginian sailors could travel around the Iberian Peninsula. They could trade with the Britannic natives of Cornwall for the tin needed to make bronze. And we know, I've said this in other meetings, I said this last week, there was trade between the Phoenicians and the Carthaginians in Cornwall for that tin, in the Bronze Age, centuries before the Phoenicians settled Carthage. Now, the Carthaginians always look back fondly to Tyre, which was a really ancient city. I mean, it was like Tyre was nearly 2,000 years old when they founded Carthage. So this is a really ancient city here. The Carthaginians look back fondly to it, but the fact was Tyre had seen better days by the time they settled Carthage. They're getting oppressed by the Assyrians. Later, the Persians will come in and take over. They wind up paying a lot of tribute to people to keep the Tyrian, Sidonian, all of the stuff on the Levant, all those routes open. And they really appreciate not just Carthage's attention, but their regular tributes of 10% of their profits they're sending to Tyre every year. Tyre becomes less and less as the important as the political and the social climate changes in the Mediterranean. And in that vacuum, Carthage becomes the great Phoenician power instead of Tyre. And a lot of the way it does that is through the Carthaginian navy. Now, when they first settled Carthage, the colonists paid rent to their African neighbors for the surrounding land. The land, like most Phoenician settlements, was protected on most sides by water. On the landward side, they built a high wall, and the Carthaginians generally kept good relations with their neighbors. They made alliances, including marriage alliances, with local Berber chieftains and warlords. You had a lot of the locals coming in for work, as frequently happens when cities spring up near what had formerly been more wild areas. And the Carthaginians also have a steady supply of mercenary troops for land wars. Throughout their history, Carthage will rely largely on mercenary troops for landlords. They did have some trained armies and soldiers from the noble families. They had a couple of excellent generals. I'll be talking about their most famous general next week. But the Carthaginians just, by and large, were never particularly comfortable on land. But put them out at sea, and they were a really formidable opponent. The Phoenicians got rich sailing around the Mediterranean, trading wares with local populations. They knew the Mediterranean. They knew their trade routes like the back of their hand. They built up in Carthage around an artificial harbor that could hold several hundred warships, and they could fill those ships at any time with seasoned sailors who have extensive experience in naval war and in fighting off pirates. In fact, around 500 BC, a Carthaginian mariner named Hanno is tasked with setting up some Carthaginian outposts along the West African coasts. We know that Hanno set up several small settlements along the Moroccan coast, and we know that he went further south in his explorations. With his records, we could tell he got at least as far as modern-day Sierra Leone, but he mentions bringing back furs from what he called a tribe of hairy women. The word that he used in Phoenician, we don't have the Phoenician original, but we do have the way the Greeks translated the word the natives used to describe these hairy warriors, and it was gorilla. Now, gorilla, we believe today, comes from Ngodida. That's a Kikongo word, and that's interesting because Kikongo is spoken in the Congo region. That is over 2,500 miles southeast of Sierra Leone. Not only that, you do see chimpanzees in Sierra Leone. You don't see gorillas until you get considerably further south than Sierra Leone. Now, it's possible Hanno traveled further south than he let on. I mean, we know the Phoenicians and the Carthaginians guarded their trade routes like they were commercial secrets. You don't want people knowing where you're getting those resources from and like cutting out the middleman. Also a possibility that Hanno did not in fact fight these hairy women with his troops the way he claimed he did, that he bought these skins in trade and that he came back with a story about what the natives called an Ngodida. And that would mean, you know, even if we assume that Hanno was lying, that this looks like some very good evidence that we had trade routes in late 6th century BC Africa, which stretched at least as far north as Sierra Leone and originated in the Congo. That's a distance that's roughly about as far from my home in New Jersey to Houston, Texas. We also know that the Carthaginians had links with the caravans that crossed the Sahara out of the south. They would bring gold, ivory, and slaves. The Carthaginians would exchange with them salt, beads, woven cloth, and cheap pottery. Pretty good deal if you can get it. And within a century or two after its founding, Carthage is home to several hundred thousand people. It's the control center for trade networks that stretch from Mesopotamia to Central Africa. This is centuries before the Mediterranean becomes the Roman Lake, and it is literally the Carthaginian pond. And now that we've talked about this, let's talk about the question that's probably been on your mind since I got started. Did the Carthaginians make a sacrifice to Moloch? Okay, there's been an attempt for going on over a century now to treat the stories of Phoenician baby sacrifice as racist propaganda by people who hated them. There are archaeologists today who will insist the Carthaginian Tophet is really a cemetery for stillborn infants. There's not just solid archaeological evidence for Carthaginian and Phoenician baby sacrifice. There's overwhelming textual evidence for Canaanite human sacrifice. Remember, the Phoenicians and Carthaginians identify themselves as Canaanim, Canaanites. Now, one of the core founding Canaanite myths, it's the founding myth of several monotheistic religions, involves Abram and his near sacrifice of his firstborn son. In the book of Judges, you have a Shofet, a judge named Jephthah. He vows to sacrifice the first thing that runs up to him when he arrives back home from a victory. He has his daughter runs up to him and embraces him, and Jephthah then has to kill his daughter on an altar. Jeremiah complains in his Lamentations how the people of Israel had been sacrificing their children to foreign idols, to Canaanite idols, that is, and he blames the Babylonian conquest of Judea on the impiety of the people. Okay, the Torah was written down during and immediately after the Babylonian captivity. These scribes are compiling tales that they feel will address the immediate concerns of their people. They've got no really good reason to make up embarrassing stories of their grandparents sacrificing babies to foreign gods. They've got lots of reasons to put those embarrassing stories aside, and yet they included those baby sacrifice accounts. And okay, with that being said, I will clear up one misconception. The Carthaginians did not sacrifice their children to Moloch. Their primary Carthaginian gods were the goddess Tanit and the god Baal Haman. Baal Haman, like Adonis, dies each autumn and he's born each spring. I'll note that the new Carthage, the site that springs up when the Romans rebuild after leveling Carthage and which has a large Punic population, becomes a major center for Christianity, which is, of course, another religion that rather prominently features a dying and reborn god. In Punic, a sacrifice was called a mulk. That's where the confusion with Moloch arises. You could give Tanit and Baal Haman an animal offering. That would typically be a lamb or a kid goat. That would be a mulk imor. You could sacrifice a commoner's child. That would be a mulk adom. Or if you were Carthaginian nobility, you could give your own child. That would be a mulk baal, a lordly or a kingly sacrifice. Now, we've heard different stories of how this is done. Probably the most famous one that was repeated many times during the ancient period came from a Greek writer named Clitarchus from about 310 to 300 BC. And he had said, "There stands in their midst a bronze statue of Cronos, its hands extended over a bronze brazier, with the flames of which engulf the child. When the flames fall upon the body, the limbs contract, and the open mouth seems almost to be laughing until the contracted body slips quietly into the brazier. Thus it is that the grin is known as sardonic laughter, since they die laughing." That's inspired a lot of people. We've not found any bronze statue that matches the description that Clitarchus gives, but we have found cremated baby bones buried in ceramic jars beneath stelae in the excavated Carthage Tophet. You know, these stelae frequently say, to Tanit and Baal Haman, who heard my prayer and answered. This is my offering in exchange for the prayer that was answered. Now, at the time Carthage is founded, Tyre is paying tribute to the Assyrians. As I had said before, throughout the history of Carthage, Tyre is part of one empire or another. These rulers didn't really like the custom of baby sacrifice. They pressured the Tyrians and the Phoenicians to give up this custom. The custom of sacrificing infants appears to have died out in the Levant sometime not long after the founding of Carthage. But in Carthage, it becomes an ethnic significator. It's something that sets you apart from your neighbors. It's something that ties you to your past. And as Tyre's star falls and Carthage's rise, the Carthaginians may well have said, the reason we have so much good fortune is we still make our offerings at the Tophet. For the first 400 years of Carthage's existence, the Tophet was only open to Carthaginian nobility. Sometime in the 4th century BC, the Tophets were opened up. Tophets were opened up so any Carthaginian citizen could make an offering there, and we start seeing steles from wealthy merchants thanking Baal Haman and Tanit for hearing their prayer and answering. So sacrificing your infant may not have just been an act of piety. It may have become a status symbol. And that's just, I think, a time to start wrapping things up. We're running long again. That's a little taste of Carthaginian culture. This is the culture we're going to talk about next week. We're going to focus on that one more, on the difficulties Carthage runs into as its expanding empire starts to clash with two other expanding Mediterranean powers, the Greeks and the Romans. And I will see you next week. Until then, this has been Kanaz Filin, and thank you for staying here for Ancient History in 15 Minutes. Give a few minutes.